from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. Coming up in the hour ahead, journalist John Mualim talks about the lengths some people will go to save animals on the brink of extinction. He has a new book out that considers how, for a culture steeped in animal imagery and references, we're on the verge of losing untold numbers of species in the next century. Many feel connected to animals, but some folks go to extreme lengths to save those on the cusp of disappearing. Mualim channels his inner anthropologist to tell the story of three such efforts. His new book is called Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. Stay with us for a conversation with John Mualim. That's ahead on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to today's show. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. Animal imagery is all around us, from the time we're young children reading books filled with farm animals and wild critters, to sports teams that carry animal names like powerful totems, and then throughout our adult lives, animal references, pictures, and lore permeate our world. Clearly, despite our distance from a wild or even agrarian lifestyle, we hold fast to our connection with animals and what they represent. Yet scientists estimate that half of all wild animals could be gone by the turn of the century. This reality has been a long time coming, but a growing urgency about the plight of so many species has emerged in the last half century or so, even more so in the past decade, as global warming has shifted population die-offs from a far-off hypothetical to a very real and visible phenomenon underway with evaporating ice fields, drying stream beds, and clear-cut forests. So while the general public may take note and express concern, there is yet another whole category of people who take up the cause of saving species on the brink and sometimes go to extreme lengths to do so. Bay Area-based journalist John Mualim is interested in those people who've taken the cause of conservation as far as they can, going all in to protect animals at risk of disappearing forever. He followed three such storylines, looking at the complex intersection between animals and people working on behalf of their survival. And this is in his new book, which is called Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. John Mualim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, I want to talk about how animals crop up again and again in your work, in your reporting, in your writing, in your articles, and now here in this book. But they do so from the vantage point less of somebody who's sort of an armchair zoologist and more from somebody who's like an anthropologist, an ethnographer almost. You seem really taken by the way people absorb animals and animal lore into their life. And I'm wondering, what's that from?
Sure. I mean, you know, I live in San Francisco. I live in a city. I grew up in suburban New Jersey. The way, you know, some kids might go hunting with their father or camping or hiking. You know, I watched PBS shows like Wild America with my father. That was sort of my only exposure to wildlife. And I had this kind of vicarious, you know, fascination with it, a very childlike fascination that just kind of carried over into adulthood. So when I started reporting for the Times Magazine, I think in the way that, you know, another person in their mid-20s who had this opportunity might try to use it to get as close to, you know, an NBA player or a movie star or something like that, I wanted to go out and look at animals because they were sort of always at a distance away from me. And I was curious about what the reality was as opposed to all these images that you're mentioning that we're surrounded by.
So here's this sort of baseline interest you've got. And then you have a child. And boy, does it come smack in your face that animals were almost indoctrinated the way we with our children, we start bringing them up on Farmer in the Dell and EIEIO and all these animal lore in an almost I remember when I had children, I thought, why do they assume that children understand all these animal references? We don't live on a farm and we're not Rudyard Kipling in India. And yet kids' lore really brings it to the fore.
Yeah, it's instantaneous. When we had our first daughter, Isla, I was just amazed right away, you know, between stuffed animals, polar bear pajamas, sippy cups with, you know, elk on it, things that you wouldn't necessarily even imagine that a kid would understand, just surrounded by these things. We actually just had a second daughter a couple weeks ago, and you know, she's born, and they take her eventually, and they put her in the incubator or the heating lamp, and right on the lamp is a picture of a panda, and it just sort of struck me that, you know, this is a little insane. You know, as someone put it to me, right when we're learning to be human, we're surrounded by animals.
What do you think that's about? Do you think that's about some kind of inner pull, a primal self that we are way more connected to animals than we either want to admit or even recognize?
Well, I think there's a lot of scientific research looking at whether or not people have an innate kind of affinity for animals or some well of attention that's inborn that will immediately focus on other living things in a way that we wouldn't focus on a toy or a block of wood and things like that. So I think there is some evidence for that. I also think it has to do with how the adults imagine the animals that we're giving to the kids. I think there's an idea in our culture right now that animals are these peaceful, somewhat noble creatures that live off in the woods autonomously, and they represent this better, purer world somehow, a world that we've strayed from here in our, you know, in our society. So I think it's natural that you want to surround your children with those kinds of creatures as a kind of model for them, or to keep them company kind of in their innocence.
It does make you wonder how, you know, we are so removed now in our daily lives, most of us, from the reality of animals. And it wasn't that long ago that animals were the enemy. Animals could kill us. Animals stomped through our fields and ruined our crops. And the romanticization of the animal kingdom has got to be pretty brand new.
Right. You know, in a way, nature can only seem that pure and innocent when you're not afraid of it anymore. And I write a lot of...
And when it's not daily barking at your, you know, doorstep.
Exactly. Which for us in San Francisco, it's really not, aside from maybe some raccoons and crows and whatnot. But, you know, I write a lot of historical stories in the book as well. And one of them is, you know, about the invention of the teddy bear, which happened in the early 20th century. It's a fairly involved story, but basically it came about after Teddy Roosevelt went on a hunting trip and refused to shoot this very sick-looking bear that had been tied up by his guide. He showed it mercy, and there was a famous political cartoon drawn of this incident in which the president was basically pardoning this bear. And suddenly the bear, which had been a real shorthand for all the danger and menace out there on the frontier that people were grappling with every day, suddenly flipped in our minds into something very cuddly, a victim that needed our protection. And this was because basically we were eradicating all the bears at that time. We had beaten them into this kind of underdog, and once we had rendered them powerless, we could feel empathy for them once again.
Sure, once they're not a threat, once they're not a... I do think there was a funny follow-up story to that I think is in your book about how the next president, they tried to do the same, you know, lovely move of tagging him with an animal and making this great connection, but wasn't it with a possum? It didn't go over
right,
so well.
Right, so it was William Howard Taft who came after Roosevelt, and at this time, people just assumed, you know, Teddy Bear, it was for Teddy Roosevelt. They thought it was a piece of campaign propaganda, and it was very bizarre that children would be playing with a bear, this monster, as opposed to a baby doll. It was very confusing for adults. And also just the whole industry of manufactured toys was brand new. So here was the toy industry saying, well, we've got to jump on this. Once Roosevelt leaves office, no one's going to want to play with teddy bears again. And there was an effort to make the Billy Possum after
Billy Possum,
William Howard Taft, which was a stuffed possum, after Taft had been served a possum at a dinner in Georgia. The boosters of Taft's in the South started a company to make the Georgia Billy Possum and try to present this as the next cuddly plaything for America's children.
Do you think also there's some, and this is not to pop psychologize it too much, but it's so pervasive, the animals in our children's worlds and in stories that are written today, it's so pervasive that it's almost desperate. It's clinging. We're clinging to something that's no longer part of our daily life.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I feel that myself. I can speak for myself on that front as just a person and a parent. You know, there's a lot of anxiety wrapped up in a lot of these issues about extinction and climate change and environmentalism. There's a certain pang I feel sometimes when I think about the future. And that was really sort of the genesis of this book, that, you know, here I was with a daughter that I was surrounding with these peaceful, lovable animal imagery. And at the same time, I was reading these scientific reports, you know, called The End of the Wild and Our Dying Planet, and just feeling a little fraudulent. You know, what was I teaching her about the world by you know, surrounding her with this kind of, you know, ecological innocence?
an Eden, surrounding her with an Eden that just isn't going to
exist.
A cartoon Eden. All right. So about the book, now you ended up choosing three storylines. You had to kind of narrow it down. And I have to say, I wasn't surprised by the polar bear storyline because lots of high profile stories could glom onto that. Great images, great drama. The whooping crane, again, I could see that one. But you also selected to tell the story about a butterfly, and it's a local story. Talk a little bit about how you selected the three stories, but the butterfly in particular.
Sure. I mean, I wanted to pick three animals that I could use as a jumping off point, so that each section of the book is framed around the story of this particular animal, but also all of the characters that are involved in it, both, you know, professional, but also mostly amateur. A lot of just ordinary citizens, ordinary people who have either involved themselves in the recovery of this species or just feel some kind of idiosyncratic attachment to it. How did I choose them? It wasn't very scientific. I just sort of grabbed onto the stories that seemed interesting to me. And the butterfly was one that I actually didn't know too much about when I started. I just took a gamble and it seemed to pay off. It's called the Lang's Metal Mark. It lives in Antioch Dunes National Wildlife Refuge, which I had never heard of. I've lived here about 8 years. I'd never heard of it. It's just in Antioch, but between San Francisco and Sacramento on the San Joaquin River. And it's really just this scrap of land. It's about 65 acres. There's a waste transfer station on one side. There's a water treatment facility on the other. There's a biker bar.
How'd you even come to know about it?
Someone had mentioned this to me, this as a case to me where it's a species that its whole ecological context has pretty much disappeared. And yet we human beings are still able, through great ingenuity and just manual labor, we're able to keep it going on this land, even though the land where it's living is nothing like where it evolved to live. There's actually a wallboard factory, a big manufacturing plant right in the middle of the property that splits it in two. So this is, you know, it doesn't look like a wildlife refuge at all that you'd imagine, and yet the butterflies managed to hang on there.
And it's really a very unromantic storyline because it's flat out human abuse and use of the land around it. There's no great drama around that. And the preservation effort, not a great romantic story either. So it's the most un-Martha Stewart version, since Martha Stewart is doing the polar bear side of things. I thought it was a really terrific way of showing that in its humblest form, these conservation efforts can be just as impassioned.
Yeah, I found it extremely dramatic. I mean, I think that it was really an opportunity to look at one piece of land that over the course of 100 years. I mean, the destruction of Antioch Dunes really started in earnest in some ways in 1906 after the San Francisco earthquake, when they were mining the sand to make bricks to rebuild the city. And it just went downhill from there. And what I found interesting really was all these people who had been involved. I mean, it used to be a real wonderland for insect lovers and for scientists. You know, people from Davis and Berkeley, everyone would converge on this spot to study the diversity of insects there. And each generation over time just saw so much horrible development and depredation of the landscape that they would give up on it. And then the next generation of bug lovers would come along and they would think, oh, what a fantastic place. And you just got to see this cycle play out, which to me told me more about human psychology than about anything ecological.
All right. So to dive into one avenue, which I always find really interesting, what are the personality types of the folks that dive into bug conservation?
It's a wild world. That was one of the best parts of reporting this book, was getting to know the butterfly people, as I call them sometimes.
Which are a very different breed of people than ant people, which is a different breed of people than salamander people. I mean, the types of people that gravitate towards certain animals really are distinct.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, there's some space in the middle of the Venn diagram between them all. You know, some moth lovers are also butterfly lovers and whatnot. But yeah, you know, butterfly people, lepidopterists and just, you know, enthusiasts are really a peculiar subculture and just with so much passion. You know, these are people who will have an encyclopedic knowledge of being able to spot a butterfly, you know, as it zips by and know what it is, just like a birder would know different kinds of birds. And that was, you know, I'd never even occurred to me that you could do that. And now, you know, I've got a field guide and me and my daughter will go on Bernal Hill and look for butterflies. But, you know, it's also a very kind of small and
eccentric.
Yes, eccentric. Thank you. And also very taut. You know, there's a lot of real firestorm arguments in the butterfly world over various things, whether this should be its own species or a subspecies. I just found it fascinating. I mean, I found the people and their perspective on these animals always much more interesting than the animals themselves.
And much of a clash between academics and amateurs?
Yeah, well, you know, in the history of the Bay Area butterfly scene is really a history of amateurs. You know, this is a really rich place for butterflies, ecologically speaking. A lot of the microclimates in the city and up and down the peninsula have their own species that have adapted to them. So it's almost like this Galapagos Island for butterflies, the Bay Area. And, you know, back in the Gold Rush times was when some of the first amateurs started identifying new species. I go through some famous examples. They're not famous. They're completely forgotten. But within butterfly circles, they're extremely famous. There was a cop in San Francisco named James Cottle, who was a big brawny guy. They used to say that his fist was more effective than his billy club. And he would go chase butterflies and catch butterflies. And he presented the butterfly hobby as a very rugged, manly pursuit, like hunting or hiking in the mountains. And, you know, he would chase a single butterfly for, you know, 30, 40 miles and things like this. So it was really a just like a lot of other Western stories, this was a way to discover new things and to sort of strike out. And it was really valuable. A lot of these specimens could be sold for a lot of money. So when the gold started disappearing, a lot of that energy was transformed transferred onto butterflies.
We're talking this hour with John Mualim. He's got a new book out called Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website at kqed.org/forum. And we'd especially love to hear from people who have stories of their own, of family members, grandfathers, eccentric trips into saving animals in your own local environment. Because what this book shows is, among many things, is that personal passion can take people a long ways towards satisfying their own need to connect with the animal world around them. Well, John, I want to ask you to go into a little more detail, if you would, about, let's use the Lang's butterfly. You know, you tell the story of the extreme lengths that people will go to. Talk a little bit about what's gone on in the conservation effort around this butterfly.
Sure. You know, the butterfly really turned out to be a perfect example of what a lot of scientists call conservation reliance, which basically just means that we're living in an era where, you know, humans, we've dominated the landscape. It's, you know, we're the ones that are steering ecological change right now. It's our activities. And so just as we're causing a lot of extinctions, it's also going to have to be us and our work that keeps the species propped up in place if they're going to survive. And this is the case with the butterfly. You know, a long time ago, there was a real, you know, there were giant sand dunes at Antioch Dunes. Right now, there's really nothing that's recognizable as a sand dune. It's been, the ground has been stabilized, the sand's been carted away, and we've got a lot of weeds and, you know, invasive plants taking over. And this makes it very hard for the butterfly to survive because it needs a particular kind of buckwheat plant on the land where it lays its eggs and it eats the plant as well. So basically, you've got now a situation where we want the butterfly there. In fact, we're obligated to have the butterfly there because it's an endangered species. So basically, the federal government has said this is a priority. This is America's priority. And so you've got people who are breeding the butterfly in a kind of ramshackle lab in Southern California, and then bringing the larva up and walking around the dunes and depositing them on plants, sort of distributing them, laying their eggs for them in a way. And then you've got a Fish and Wildlife Service employee, a great guy named Louis Terrazas, who's out there most of the year just pulling weeds out of the ground and spraying and trying to give the buckwheat plant that the butterfly needs a fighting chance to survive there. We're really recreating the habitat, and we're also creating the butterflies in a lab and then putting them into the habitat that we've prepared for them.
So it really redefines wild.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it redefines wild so much as it totally destroys our current definition of wild.
Or what we're considering preserving a wild animal is constructing an environment. I mean, it's certainly not a zoo, and it's certainly not a contained space, I guess, but we are constructing a wild that will sustain an animal.
Exactly. And that's not unusual at all. This is just how things are these days. I mean, so many endangered species are in this condition of conservation reliance, and the interventions we have to do on their behalf are just really bizarre on the face of it. I mean, when you sort of zoom out and you look at these things, I mean, there's plans to shoot barred owls to make room for spotted owls. There's efforts where people are carrying salamanders across highways so that they can safely get on their migration route. We're monitoring animals with, you know, satellite and infrared camera and even drones sometimes.
And have you seen those images of freeways, wild freeways that are crossing actual automobile freeways? They're throughways for wildlife so that they can cross big thoroughfares.
Absolutely. Wildlife corridors. That's a big, you know, that's an exciting thing in conservation right now is how are we going to basically, help animals through a human landscape? And the interventions just get more and more bizarre as you go along. I mean, we're at the point where basically, I went to the Bonneville Dam at the Oregon-Washington border on the Columbia River. And this is just a huge multi-million-dollar project to get salmon through or around this dam we've put right in the middle of the river that they have to migrate up and down, down to the point where inside the dam, I spent a few hours with a woman named Janet, who in her job, she's she was a stay-at-home mom, and now she's a fish counter. Her job is to sit inside this dam and look out a window into the river and just count the salmon that go by and click away at this keyboard. And that was when it really started hitting home for me. Okay, we are at the point where we are employing a woman to count fish all day. That's a pretty unique relationship of one species to another than probably at any other time in the history of our planet.
But what you just said was so critical when you said that we're accommodating an animal environment in a human environment, because basically there's not a lot of space anymore that doesn't have, even national parks have human elements, have human camping. So any wild space, any preservation of a wild animal is going to assume interaction with a human community.
Right. They're relying on us. And what that really means, too, and what really drew me into this whole subject is that if they're relying on us for our survival, it's going to be our imagination and our emotional response to them and the way we understand or misunderstand or are completely ignorant of their place on Earth that's going to dictate their standing on the planet. If we, don't care about something, it's very likely to disappear. If we really care about something, it's maybe more likely not to disappear, depending on how well we understand what it needs for its survival.
Well, and as evidenced by Janet the fish counter and by the various people doing all kinds of small, no attention grabbing works, there is a lot of the human wants to save the brethren. The human wants to have these animals alongside us.
Yeah, it's been really amazing both when reporting the book, but then, now that I'm talking about it more, it's been really amazing to hear from people. Well, I'm part of a group of 100 people who are saving, insect communities and tall grass prairies in Illinois. Everyone seems to be able to grab onto some piece of this, really overwhelming problem and just try to, push the ball forward a little bit. And I find it amazing. I find it amazing that there's something inside of us as human beings that kind of gives us that drive and also that determination, even when things look futile, to just, try to grab it anywhere we can and just try to solve some sort of immediate problem.
Well, we're going to go to a short break, and taking us into the break is some music. We're going to talk after we have our short little break about a collaboration that John Mooallem participated in with a band called Black Prairie, developing music for the book around the different animal characters. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk more about our affection for, our connection to, and our need to experience the world with animals with John Mooallem after a short break. You can give us a call at 866-733-6786 or send questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Krasny this hour. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. We'll be back after just a bit. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. And what you're hearing there is a collaboration that John Mualim has done with a band called Black Prairie to develop music that coincides with different aspects of the book. And this music, I think, is targeted towards the polar bear chapter. Is that right, John?
Yeah. It's describing a scene at the end of, or it's a score for the scene at the end of the polar bear section where they're airlifting a tranquilized polar bear through the sky to out into the wilderness of northern Manitoba.
All right, so this is all sort of backdrop to John Mualim's book, which is called Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. And it's one where he has, in some ways, almost had this group score what might be going on, what if you were to have music playing as you were listening to the book. Am I getting that right? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, it's a little hard to define, I guess. Basically, you know, I've known a lot of the people in Black Prairie for a number of years. They're also, many of them are also in this band, the Decemberists, and I got to know them just before the Decemberists was taking off. And then when I started the book, they were just branching off to start Black Prairie. And Chris Funk, who's the guitar player in Black Prairie, and I were talking and thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to somehow make a soundtrack to a book? We didn't really know what that meant. But then, you know, they started reading the book when I was done, and I just started getting emailed these MP3 files. And yeah, that's basically what it is. I mean, it's they've sort of scored different scenes or stories in the book. You know, I like to think of it as, you know, just as I was listening to certain kinds of music when I was in these places, you know, that sort of resonated with the mood of them. You know, this music kind of puts those emotions back in. So I don't know that you need to sit and read the book while you're listening to the record or anything like that.
But how does it work? Does the book come with an access code to an MP3 or something?
Well, the music right now is streaming online, but they're releasing a CD and then a sort of limited edition vinyl thing. And you can go to Black Prairie's website and actually buy the a signed copy of the book and a signed record as a package. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's you know, it was something fun to try, and I think it, you know, from my perspective, it seems like it turned out pretty great.
What a great approach! What a great way to I don't know, multimedia everything, multi-platform. It's great. I think it's really fun. All right, well, let's that was a song that was based on a polar bear scene. So let's go on over to the phones where we have John calling from Oakland. Hi, John.
Hi there. Well, regarding polar bears, you know, it's nice to be building corridors for salamanders across the freeway, but the polar bear problem is many magnitudes bigger. Their whole continent, and I know it's not a continent, I know it's just ice, is going to disappear. And it seems like that the polar bears are gone. What's your perspective on that?
John?
Right. Well, you know, what the science says right now is that lots and lots of polar bears are definitely going to be gone, but that there's still time, if the political will's there, there's still a chance to save small populations of polar bears at the very northern part of the globe. Whether that's likely or not, you know, I don't know. To be honest, I'm not very optimistic. I mean, it seems like it would take a real wholesale change in the way we consume energy and all that stuff that's going to stop global warming in time. But this is really, you know, an extreme example of what I was talking about before, where with the polar bear, there's really nothing you can do out in the landscape. There's no weeds to pull like with the butterfly. There's no, you know, corridor you can build across a highway. It really, that animal's survival is going to come down to decisions made hundreds, if not thousands of miles away by people who have nothing to do with polar bears. And this was something, you know, that I write about in the book, where really the job of polar bear conservation right now is this weird kind of psychological guerrilla warfare, where environmental groups like Polar Bears International, who I hung out with up in Churchill, Manitoba, what they're really just trying to do is influence people. It's a hearts and minds kind of battle. It's not a scientific or ecological battle at all, really, at this point.
Well, and I think there's also there's the aspect of saving the big beast, the megafauna. Say it's a giant panda, which is, you know, taking a lot of time and energy saving the giant panda. Well, when you're saving a giant panda, you're not just saving the giant panda. You're saving the habitat that the giant panda lives in. You're saving all the microfauna. You're saving all the flora. So the big animals, the polar bear, it's not as narrow as being directed to save the polar bear. When you save that one large animal, you're de facto saving a lot.
Well, so that brings up an interesting issue. I mean, yes, that's true. That's what conservationists tell us all the time. And in a lot of cases, that's absolutely true, that the animal is a mechanism to set aside all of this land and this greater ecosystem. in a lot of cases, though, that's just not true. In a lot of cases, we really are just focused on saving the animal. I mean, the butterfly is a perfect example, and there's a lot like it, where we really are just saving the animal, even as the entire ecological context around it has disappeared. And what's interesting about the polar bear right now is that, you know, we all associate polar bears with climate change. The environmentalists have done a really good job of making that animal a kind of mascot, a sympathetic victim for us to grab onto. But really, we're nearing the point where polar bear conservation and fighting climate change are really diverging. They're going to become two different things. It's no longer, you know, there's going to be polar bear populations that die out no matter what we do with our energy policies. And so now you're starting to see discussions about, should we be shipping roadkill up to Churchill, Manitoba and putting it out so that polar bears can eat it? Should we be now shifting to that kind of direct intervention to save polar bears, even if it means we're doing nothing to combat the bigger problem of climate change?
And also if it means that you're taking away an entire aspect of their wildness.
Right. And that's the big philosophical issue at the crux of this. You know, I describe in the book a photographer who had filmed basically two polar bear cubs starving out on the tundra outside Churchill. And he put the video online thinking this is could be some really iconic footage. This was right at the time of a round of climate talks. And he thought putting this out there and knowing that this cub starving is something that's going to be a symptom of climate change from here on out could really rally people and stir up their emotions. And then you had a whole other class of people saying, why did you film it? Why didn't you put the camera down and throw these cubs some meat? You know, he thought this was a really poetic way to help polar bears. Everyone else, well, not everyone else, but a lot of other people saw it as a film of him not helping polar bears.
Well, and that's a classical journalism quandary as well. Do you take the picture or do you save the starving child? That sort of thing. So that's a different context for an age-old problem. Talking this hour with John Mualim, if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And we've got Catherine calling from Sebastopol. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the property I bought about 18 months ago up here in Sebastopol. It's an absolute sanctuary for wildlife. And I met up with this. I wanted a butterfly garden. I thought it would be a great place. It's all organic. And I got in touch with this woman, Louise Hallberg, who's sort of a butterfly lady icon up here. And she gives classes with the universities and all that. And just impressed me how valuable it is to kind of create an environment for them, for the butterflies. So, I mean, I guess what I'm talking about is just reaching out to other people that value this, because I was going to sell this land because I wanted to go higher and drier, but because I'm on the watershed. But now I value this property so much because of the watershed. It brings all these animals.
And Catherine, have you met up with a community of people who share your point of view?
You know what? Funny enough, even in Sebastopol, I struggle to kind of connect with people who are at this level because, you know, it's so switched on up here. But, you know, we have a ways to go. Even in the farming community, it's, you know, all about growing food and all that. But I feel a lot of people are towards the, you know, plow it up with a tractor sort of concept. And as far as I can understand with butterflies, that's not the best thing for them. I mean, you know, really pitchfork, mm-hmm. sort of turning over the soil, permaculture and all that. We've ways to go. Even in this community, there's a lot of synthetic fertilizers and all that, you know, going on.
Bit by bit, though. Bit by bit. Bit by bit. Thanks, Catherine.
Yeah, bit by bit. So I'm trying to, you know, just preserve what's going on, and I plant things that are native that would be
That's a good springboard. John, why don't you talk about that a little bit, about how, you know, this may not be the three stories that you focused on in your book, but in your traveling around, to what extent are people working just in small ways to alter their own little tiny piece of habitat to accommodate bats or butterflies or animals that might be in the backyard?
Yeah, I think that's happening all over the place. And in some ways, I think that's the the most important or at least the most meaningful kind of work you can do. I mean, we're not all going to be dealing with endangered whooping cranes. You know, we're not actually legally allowed to deal with endangered whooping cranes.
And tell us the whooping – okay, so start us off with whooping cranes because the story here is phenomenal. Go into some of the detail about the characters you've come across.
Sure, yeah. The whooping crane, for people that don't know, is it's the tallest North American bird. It's a big white bird. And basically this is a case where by the 1940s there were between 20 and 30 left. You know, it was really just on the outs. And ever since then, there's been a progressively more bizarre-seeming series of projects undertaken to rebuild the whooping crane. And it's worked in large measure. I mean, now there's about...
Okay, you say bizarre. Tell us.
Okay, well, right now, the people that I spent a fall with... it's a nonprofit called Operation Migration. And what they're doing is part of a partnership with other groups and the government is teaching whooping cranes to fly behind a ultralight aircraft, which is almost like a hang glider with a little amusement park car looking cab dangling underneath it.
And why would one need to teach a whooping crane to fly?
Yes, this is an interesting juncture we're on planet Earth when we need people to teach cranes to fly. And why they're doing this is that these cranes have been bred in a lab in Maryland, in a government lab. So normally a wild crane would learn to migrate by following its parents. But these birds' parents are back in the lab in Maryland. So these planes, the pilots and the planes, have to step in as a proxy for those adults. And so they train them to fly behind these planes. And then in the fall, they set out from Wisconsin all the way to Florida. It's almost 1,300-mile trip. And they're stopping every 25-50 miles every night, on landowners' property. And there's RVs, you know, coming under the highway, underneath them on the highways, and a Cessna flying overhead. It's really involved. And what I didn't mention is that actually while they're all doing this, they're wearing these big frumpy white costumes because they don't want the birds to know that they're following a human being.
Right.
The birds need to believe they're following either another bird or just some big unidentifiable white thing so that when they get to Florida and they're on their own for the rest of their lives, they're going to be able to live as wild animals and not like, you know, the Canada geese that like to hang out on our soccer fields if you feel very comfortable around humans.
And where is this project taken the crane population so far?
Well, this is the interesting thing about this project is this is actually rebuilding or building from scratch a second crane population that just didn't exist before. The surviving population lives in Texas and commutes back and forth to Alberta, and this one's going from Wisconsin to Florida. So they've basically just built a second population to give the entire species a better chance of survival.
And some of the characters you met in the process of covering this story?
Yeah, I mean, the folks of Operation Migration especially are just really, really wonderfully exaggerated examples of a lot of the people I met. I mean, they're all amateurs. They're not, they're pilots. They're not scientists. They all came to this work in really idiosyncratic and different ways, like pretty much everyone I met during the course of the book. One of the pilots was flying these planes as a hobby while he was a commercial photographer taking photos of luxury cars in Big Sur. He was living in Toronto, was living this kind of playboy lifestyle, and then suddenly, a buddy of his started flying with geese behind his plane, started training geese to fly behind his plane, and slowly, he built into a greater understanding of what this could accomplish, and now he's a full-time environmentalist
and a markedly unselfconscious group.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to their credit, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Operation Migration in the fall of 2010 following their migration. And, just by chance, it was actually a pretty brutal year for them. There was a lot of bureaucratic, kind of nastiness in the partnership they're part of and a lot of uncertainty about the future of the project. But they were very open with me, and I was there all along and trying to see some of these decisions and arguments play out. And in the end, I really felt that, even though, sure, there was some petty disagreements and they all seemed very human and very flawed, in a way, I just walked away feeling, even more admiring of them that in addition to all the ecological hurdles they're having to overcome, there was this human sloppiness that they're having to overcome as well, which is, I think, true of all this work.
Well, talk a little bit about the intersection between the passionate amateurs who are giving their lives over to this and the bureaucracy of working with wildlife in America.
Sure. Well, yeah, and this is true all over just because there's no budgets for a lot of this work. So a lot
and
of
isn't there a lot of regulation? I mean, if whooping cranes are wild animals, and so to handle the egg, my guess is that there's a lot of logistical hoops.
Oh, there's an incredibly complicated permitting process. It's layers and layers of red tape. This is what the kind of bureaucracy that the Endangered Species Act has built up around these animals.
And yet it's inhibiting a very kind of honorable effort by local and amateur folks to do their best. And yet they have to kind of get through so much red tape in order to do what they're trying to do.
Sure. I mean, I think sometimes it inhibits it. Absolutely. I mean, there's many cases, I'm sure, and the butterfly is one of them. I mean, all that butterfly needs is that buckwheat plant to survive. If you went up to, you know, Buena Vista Park and planted a field of buckwheat up there and then brought butterflies over, they'd probably have a good shot of surviving up there. And we could, you know, double or triple the population if we moved them off that one scrap of land. But that's not the mentality. The mentality is to keep the butterfly, you know, where it was when we found it. And I think that the Endangered Species Act is, you know, it's a very powerful law, and it probably hinders just as much progress as it creates.
Well, and it's helpful, but as you say, I mean, it I can imagine gets in the way of all kinds of ground, you know, grassroots efforts. Do you find yourself, after such a close-up look at people who are doing such good work, eccentric, but good. Do you find yourself optimistic, pessimistic? How do you feel about what your daughters were going to see when they're taking their kids out to the fields?
Yeah, you know, I definitely started the book from a place of pessimism, or at least, you know, real worry. And, you know, I don't quite know if I got all the way to optimism, but I got to a kind of a comfort, you know, a feeling that there's something, there's a rightness to what a lot of these people are doing, a kind of something deep and very human about it. You know, I think that there's a lot of books that are proposing, you know, pat solutions or celebrating these endangered species successes. And I think that's great. But I think when I scratch the surface of those stories and realize how much more complicated they are than a lot of the kind of, you know, fairy tale stories that we tell ourselves, you know, I realize, well, I don't have any answers for fixing a world that's this broken. But I think that trying to learn to live in a world that's broken is a much, you know, it's a noble challenge in and of itself. And maybe that means striking out on your own and trying to do some of this work. Or maybe that just means, you know, thinking about it more deeply and trying to situate yourself in the world in a more meaningful way.
All right. Let's hear from Kapil, who's calling from San Jose. Good morning.
Good morning. It's been both a fascinating and very inspiring conversation that I've been hearing into. We spoke about grassroots efforts a while ago and wanted to expand that question a little bit more. So this is a theme that many of the readers would probably relate to. Growing up as children, there's always a fascination towards animals and the natural world, and probably the professions children want to do is very different than the professions adults end up taking as stereotypes, essentially. So two questions, essentially. What could be some of those easy steps, baby steps that listeners like me could take to actually start getting involved in these conservation efforts, typically in a highly urban world, I would say.
All right.
And two, is there a wider ecosystem of a collection of maybe blogs, a collection of curated articles, ecosystem that thrives on the efforts of these amateurs that they could actually piggyback on?
All right, Kapil, thanks so much. So baby steps and blogs.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of volunteering opportunities. I mean, like I said, a lot of this work relies on volunteers just kind of getting out there and doing grunt work in a lot of different ways. I mean, I think the most important thing that people can do, and what I've really realized through the process of this book, is just kind of noticing things, you know, noticing the animals that live around you, whether it's, you know, maybe it's just raccoons and starlings and you don't think that's all too sexy, but, you know, this is our nature. This is what we live around.
And are there blogs that you know of or kind of aggregate sites that have a lot of animal, wildlife, local wildlife sort of info?
Yeah, you know, I can't really recommend one central clearinghouse for that stuff. I mean, it's a pretty disorderly online world of sites that write about this sort of thing. I'd hesitate to point at just one.
I want you to talk a little bit, if you would. You're going to be speaking about your book on June 12th at Pop-Up Magazine, which will produce a live mini issue about animals as the book is launching at the chapel in San Francisco's Mission District. And I want you first to talk a little bit. We only have a minute or so. What is Pop-Up Magazine? And for folks who want to look it up while he's talking, it's popupmagazine.com is where you can get more information. But I love this idea. So tell us about Pop-Up Magazine.
Yeah, so Pop-Up Magazine is an event series that started here in San Francisco. They're doing a big thing tonight at Davies Symphony Hall with McSweeney's and Beck. They're doing a special issue for Beck's Songreader, which is just going to be absolutely fantastic. And I've been, you know, part of this is the first pop-up show I haven't been part of, actually. I've been part of them all going back to the first one. So the event we're going to be doing on June 12th, which I guess is going to be officially announced in a couple days on Pop-Up's website, or you can follow them or me on Twitter and Facebook. Is going to be this kind of special mini sidebar issue just with radio people and writers and artists all presenting stories about animals. And then I'll be doing some telling some stories from the book that are going to be orchestrated on stage by Black Prairie, who are coming down from Portland to do some of the music. And then Black Prairie will just play a show after that.
And this idea of Pop-Up Magazine, the idea that it's a live onstage magazine.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I mean, it just happens that night. You can't film it. There's no, there's nothing for posterity, and it's a really beautiful thing. I've really enjoyed being part of it.
All right, so that will be on June 12th with a special edition focusing on animals at the chapel in San Francisco's Mission District. And Pop-Up Magazine, again, .com is the site to go to. Well, this is a fundraising time at KQED, and you can go to kqed.org for more information about how you can contribute to the station and to programs like Forum. I'm Penny Nelson. You're listening to Forum. And I think let's hear from some of our listeners here at that have written into the website. Caroline writes, I just read Wild Ones and want to say it's my new favorite book. I was already an animal lover, but never a fan of the human species. Strangely, Mr. Mualim has given me a new faith in my fellow man, even as he tells us that it's probably all too late. Oh, I don't think you're saying that. You're not saying that. And Ken writes, great show. I always have to ask your guests associated with wildlife their opinions on hunting and fishing. I'm an avid waterfowl hunter and fly fisherman and contribute to conservation groups like Ducks Unlimited and Trout Unlimited. Does your guest view the sporting communities as friends or foes? We do a lot to save wildlife, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think that it's really ignorant to vilify hunting and fishing as, you know, just what we might have thought it was 100 years ago in terms of just, you know, brazen destruction. You know, hunters and fishermen do a lot of good work. And also there's some species that it's a really good thing that are being hunted, like deer or geese. I mean, this is a part of being an ecological citizen is participating in this kind of process of limiting populations. So,
well, and I've often found that people that are hunters and fisher folk, they have a much deeper and closer understanding to the land than a lot of people who are strong opponents. They're out there, they're walking, they're getting down and dirty. And personally, I always think they have a lot more connection than a lot of folks who cry foul. Pardon the expression. Pardon the expression. So when you we talked a little bit about this, but when you think about your daughters moving forward, they're kids now, the world of the wild will be different when they are adults, but it's been different always. So, you know, as obvious as it seems, dinosaurs no longer exist. They're still part of our world and our psyche and everything. The mammoth no longer exists. Europe used to be populated with lions and bears and all kinds of big forbidding beasts that are no longer there. So what do you think about the idea that, yes, animals are slipping away, but the natural world has always been going through transition?
Yeah, I think, I mean, of course, the change is inevitable on Earth. I mean, it sounds like an obvious thing to say, but yet again, so many of the ways we conceive of ecological problems seem to take for granted that there is a static condition that we have to lock in place and protect. You know, it was amazing as I looked at not just the three animals that are the focus of those chapters, but sort of spun off into other stories as well, how pervasive that that mindset is. I mean, yes, it's true that we are accelerating change and we're, you know, creating all sorts of cockamamie effects that weren't there without
human
influence.
Well, and also, I don't mean to say that it isn't drastic, the numbers that are falling away.
Sure.
It's untold in human history. So that's dramatically different. But my father's childhood idea of wild is completely different than mine. And my child's will be completely different as well.
Right. And I think that, you know, one thing I realized, and I alluded to this before, is that the human capacity for wonder and to appreciate nature, no matter what condition it's in, is pretty miraculous. I mean, I saw in researching some of the historical characters in the book, you know, a guy named William Temple Hornaday, who was really one of America's first, you know, modern conservationists in the early 20th century, you know, he died in the 30s and died thinking that the whole continent was ruined. You know, but then, of course, as one of his biographers pointed out to me, Ronald Reagan was born just about the same time, right around where Hornaday was born. And Ronald Reagan talked about walking through the woods and what natural glory there was and how that, you know, inspired him to love America. So the world that Hornaday left behind that he thought was ruined was really the world that a guy like Reagan came along and loved.
What's before we go, what's going on with the butterfly research right now?
You know, I haven't checked in this, so it's just about the time when they're ramping up the weed control there, because the butterflies are going to be hatching in August, and they want to get everything ready for them. I know that they had another, you know, a rough year last year again. They measure it by a peak count, which is the number of butterflies you can count in an afternoon, and it's still in double digits. I don't remember what the number was last year. You know, when I was there, they peak count, I think, was 46. And it hasn't really budged beyond that. So they're dealing with a lot of problems there. They're still trying to figure out exactly the best way to go about their work.
Now, my guess is that you were not able to cover a lot of stories in your book that you thought were totally worthy. Are there other Bay Area little gem stories that are going on that people should prick up their ears about?
Well, one of the people I wrote about in the book is a guy named Liam O'Brien, who's a local guy who is a, you know, big time butterfly lover, butterfly expert, completely self-taught. And I just saw him the other day, and he was telling me about a new project he's involved in where, and I apologize, Liam, I forget what kind of butterfly it is right now, but there's a butterfly that is living on the trees up and down Market Street, that is basically treating Market Street like a river. And these trees on the river, you know, as if they were on a riverbed. And it's and so it's living on these trees. And that's the ecosystem it's chosen for itself. So he's working right now with the people who are looking at redeveloping Mid-Market and trying to find out if they can leave a place for the butterfly that's sort of wound its way into this niche.
And my guess is for anyone who's got a hearkening in their heart to do it, there's lots of terrific and eccentric and interesting little projects out there. You just start Googling and you'll find something that captures you.
Yeah, you can't possibly keep up with everything going on. So.
All right. Well, we're going to go out with some music from Black Prairie that's from the Whooping Crane song. And again, that's Black Prairie, which is a collaborative effort with the book Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. The author is our guest for this hour, John Mualim. And thanks so much for being with us. And also, June 12th, Pop-Up Magazine will do an animal special. Go to popupmagazine.com for information about that. That's it for today's show. Danny Bringer is our engineer today. The show is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, and Susan Bishop. Dan Zoll's the senior editor. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For Michael Krasny, I'm Penny Nelson. Thanks for listening. Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.